Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're continuing our study and concluding 1 Kings today. I must admit the lesson for today has really perplexed me in knowing how to teach it. It really covers chapters 20 through 22. It's one big context. And it's so often in these lessons that they skip from one little section to another little section, and really it messes up the context, and you can't really understand what's happening today without understanding the whole. So I think on this particular lesson, what I need to do, instead of doing a detailed word and phrase study of these isolated paragraphs through here, is for us to kind of talk through the entire context. It's going to be absolutely crucial that you read and prepare chapter 20 through 22, because there are many, many truths through here, spiritual truths. But to catch the big picture, you need to see all three chapters. Now, in 1 Kings, the title of the lesson is The Judgment on Ahab, and that's what it's basically going to be. Beginning in 1 Kings 20, what we have is Ben-Hadad II, which is the current leader of the city of Damascus and apparently one of several kings in an Arminian alliance. And he is going to wage war against the northern 10 tribes. And apparently he is much more powerful than they. He's going to besiege the city of Samaria, which is the capital of the north. Now Ahab, for some reason that's not explained in the text, God is going to help him out. God is trying to continue to work with this northern king to say, look, I'm God. He did that with Elijah on Mount Carmel. He's going to do it again. He's going to say, look, I'm going to deliver you with a much smaller force. I'm going to deliver you if you trust me. I want to show you I'm the God of the covenant. But Ahab was such a vacillating, weak man that though Yahweh showed him such tremendous signs and miracles of deliverance, his pagan wife seemed to have more influence on him than the prophets of God and God's mighty acts. But anyway, God's going to say through a prophet, an unnamed prophet, I'm going to spare the city because I want to show you that I'm really God and I'm God of the covenant, Ahab. And so what happens is Ben-Hadad offers, what he demands, gold, silver, the king's wives and the king's children. And the king says, all right, I'll do that. But then the king of Damascus comes back and says, I also want to make a search of your palace and pick anything that you like that I want. I'm going to take it. The king really balked at that search. He didn't mind giving his wives and his children his money and gold, but he didn't want that dude in his palace. And so he met with the elders who were also apparently trapped inside the capital city. And they said, you're right. This has just gone too far. We can't do it. You send a message back and tell him we can't go this far. So apparently Israel at this time was some kind of vassal to the northern power, this Arminian power anyway. But they just decided to rebel. And there was a huge number of Syrians. And the Lord asked for a specific group, kind of like Gideon. He says, give me the special young fighting men of the governors of the province. And they totaled about 230-something men. And they're going to be an advanced guerrilla guard, and about 7,000 more are going to come after with the king's leadership. Ben-Hadad was so secure, he just knew he had them against the wall, that he was absolutely inebriated in his tent. And he couldn't think clearly, and his small guerrilla group surprised his men. Now, he's going to escape on horseback, but his troops are going to be destroyed. And that's basically where we're coming from chapter 20. Now, the prophet tells him next year he'll be back. And so he raises another army. And when it came to spring, when the rains were over, and the Old Testament says the kings go out for battle, this same king, Ben-Hadad II, came back against Samaria again. And he's going to be defeated another time. But unfortunately, the king, King Ahab, is going to have mercy on him. He flees to a city, Aphek, and he is trapped, and he says, oh, maybe the king of Israel will have mercy on me. I hear he's a good man. And the king spares his life. And not only spares his life, but the king lets him come ride in his chariot and makes a covenant with him, apparently along economic lines. And we pick up then, the first part of the text we're going to study is in 1 Kings 20, beginning in verse 35, where another of these unnamed prophets gets a word from the Lord. Now a certain man, a son of the prophet, said to another by the word of the Lord, strike me. Now, when it says the sons of the prophets, there was a group of Old Testament preachers known as the sons of the prophets. There was a band of them or a group of them. We learned from a little bit later there were 400 prophets of Yahweh that were available for Ahab to consult. So there had been a radical change since that Mount Carmel experience back in chapter 18. Now, this mine has, say to another, and that's really literally in the Masoretic text, it's the word his neighbor. So it wasn't another prophet he was talking to. It's just another layman lived close to him. And he said, I want you to hit me, strike me with your fist. And the man wouldn't do it. But the man didn't understand why the prophet wanted him to hit him. What if your pastor came up and said, I want you to hit me in the eye. Would you hit him? Well, it was supposed to be a symbolic prophecy. This prophet wanted to be beat up. And then he wanted to go to the king, all beat up, and say, I was supposed to keep somebody, and I let him go. What should I do? And it was important that this prophet, someone beat him up. This man wouldn't do it. And in verse 36, this man is killed for it. A lion kills him. Now, that sounds very strange for us. That it just doesn't seem appropriate that a man should die for not hitting the prophet. But I think what the Old Testament is saying is the prophet told this man that God told him to do it. And the man still wouldn't do it. And so what it does, verse 36, talks about the seriousness of believing God's word. Same kind of thing happened with Uriah when David was bringing the ark. He said, don't touch it, you'll die. That ark almost failed. A man grabbed it to keep it from falling. But God had made a statement, if you touch it, you'll die. And the man died. And David was so mad, he wouldn't let the ark even come to Jerusalem for a while. That's the same kind of thing here, I think. Now, notice in verse 37 where it says, then another man found the man and said, please strike me. And the man struck him and wounded him. The guy must have heard about the other man. He really beat him up, okay? Verse 38. So the prophet departed and waited for the king by the way and disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes. And the king passed by, and he cried out to the king and said, your servant went out into the midst of the battle, and behold, a man turning aside and brought a man to me and said, guard this man. If for any reason he is missing, then your life shall be for his life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver. Look at verse 40. And while the servant was busy, your servant was busy doing here and there, the man was gone. And the king of Israel said to him, so shall your judgment be, you yourself have decided it. And then he hastily, the prophet, took the bandage away from his eyes, and the king of Israel recognized him, that he was one of the prophets. And the prophet said to him, thus saith the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I, God, devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life, and your people for his people. Wow. This is much like what the prophet Nathan did to David back in 2 Samuel 12. The little parable about the man who had so many sheep, and he took another man's sheep who didn't have any. And David said, well, curse on that man, he ought to die. And Nathan said, you're the man. That's exactly what this prophet did. You see, this king pronounced his own judgment, but he didn't know it. Now, when it says here, it may confuse you, in verse 42, where it says, God says, this man I have devoted to destruction. You see, this war with Ben-Hadad II was a holy war, much like the whole book of Joshua. It was a war in God's name for God's purposes. Totally given for destruction is a way of saying something is under the ban or korban, or it's dedicated to God and it becomes so holy it has to be destroyed. Now, Ben-Hadad was meant to be destroyed. But the king of Israel let him go for personal reasons and political reasons and economic reasons. And now that king's going to pay the price. Now look at verse 43. So the king of Israel went to his house sullen and vexed, and he came to Samaria. Now we kind of leave that. We know that his people are going to go into captivity. We know that he's going to die personally. But then in chapter 21, we begin a brand new context, really, about Ahab. Ahab was really down. He was all depressed. And Jezebel came and said, what's the matter with you, honey? You're not eating anything. You don't look good. You're always moping around the palace. And so Ahab, instead of answering the truth about God's prediction, says, well, I wanted this man's vineyard. I tried to buy it from him, and he wouldn't sell it to me. And I'm just sad because I didn't get the vineyard I wanted. And Jezebel says, honey, you're king, aren't you? You just leave it to me. I'll get you that vineyard. And Ahab doesn't respond, but obviously he knows Jezebel's going to do something. So Jezebel sends out all these letters in the king's name with the king's seal and has this man, his name is Naboth, called to a special honoring gathering of all the elders in the community where he lived. And she made a plot with those elders and said, I want you to get two wicked men. They're called sons of Belial. Set them on either side of Naboth. And accuse him of blasphemy against God and the king. And then I want you to stone him to death. And they did just what Jezebel said. Now, this really says to me the weakness of a man like Ahab. It also tells me the weakness that the people, the leaders of Israel, the level of low morality they'd fallen to. It also tells me of the active wickedness of Jezebel. And finally, it tells me this chapter supremely sets out that God is an ethical God. And God will require at Ahab's hands the sin done by Jezebel and the elders against that innocent man. Now, we pick up with this story then in verse 17. Okay, chapter 21, verse 17. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise, go down and meet Ahab, king of Israel, who is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone down to take possession of it." And you got to look at verses 1-16 to get the whole context here. "And you shall speak to him, saying, Thus says the Lord, you have murdered and also taken possession." Now, the word murdered here is a very important word. This is the same word used in the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:13. King James translates it, "Thou shalt not kill." That's a horrendous English translation of this Hebrew word. This is a perfect context to see what this word means. This word means premeditated murder. That's what that commandment means. Thou shalt not commit premeditated murder. You ought to know the nation like Israel, who totally destroys whole nations, women and children, was never forbidden to kill. They were forbidden to kill with a high hand or premeditated killing. That's what was forbidden. Pardon me. Now, something else I want to say about verse 19 that I think is real important. Ahab didn't kill Naboth. Jezebel really didn't kill Naboth, but she ordered it done by some henchmen, those leaders of that community. But I want you to know that it wasn't the leaders who were held accountable, though they were going to have to answer for their act. And it wasn't Jezebel held accountable, though she's going to have to answer for her acts. It's Ahab is where the buck stops, and God says, "You murdered it." And it was duplicity. He just let it happen, but he was responsible. Now, we need to realize this sense of corporality. There is a corporate sense of blessing where the children are blessed because of the faith of the parents. And there is a corporate sense of guilt where one man's sin affects an entire tribe, an entire nation. That's Old Testament, but I think it's very true. Now, "And you shall speak to him, saying, Thus says the Lord, in the place where the dogs lick the blood of Naboth, the dogs shall lick your blood, even yours." Now, this prediction is fulfilled in chapter 22, verses 35 and 38. The dogs are going to lick up Ahab's blood, too. Now, you see, there's two things involved here. Number one seems to be that the fact that the dogs will eat your body affects your afterlife some way. That somehow your body is important to the afterlife. That's why burial was so important. And second, there's almost something magical or mysterious or spiritual about the blood for the Hebrew. And for dogs to lick up a man's blood was just a horrible thing, a horrible thing. Now, in verse 20, "And Ahab said to Elijah, Have you found me, O my enemy?" Now, you know, this king is so vacillating. One time, Elijah on Mount Carmel, him and Ahab were buddy buddies. I think Elijah thought he had really repented. But as soon as Ahab got away from the prophet and back in the presence of Jezebel, he turned again. This man was like a spiritual chameleon. He was influenced by whatever group he was with. He was with the prophets. He was influenced by the prophets. He was with his pagan wife. He was influenced by his pagan wife. There are so many people like that. Spiritual chameleons just take the color of whatever group they happen to be with. God help us. Now, "And he answered, I have found you because you have sold yourself to do evil in the sight of the Lord." Now, that's repeated down in verse 25 again. Now, it's my personal belief this idea of sold yourself to evil is a corollary to the idea of being redeemed. Now, the word redeemed means to buy someone back from slavery. So the metaphor of selling oneself to evil is one side of the coin, but the metaphor of God purchasing your life back for you by grace is the other side of the coin. And this is really the source of where I think the word redeemed comes from. Now, notice what it mentions then. Verse 21, "Behold, I will bring evil upon you, and I will utterly sweep you away, will cut off from Ahab every male, both bond and free in Israel." He's going to kill the children of his concubines and the children of his wives. He's not going to have any ancestors. And that was a tragedy for these people. They felt like somehow they lived on in their posterity. But no, he's not going to have any posterity. And also, he'll have no heir to the throne. Okay? Notice that in verse 22 it says, "And I'll make your house," and it mentions two houses, "like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat." Now, you might want to see chapter 14, verses 10 and 11, where the prophet Abijah says this will happen. And the second house, the house of Bashan, and here again, that's a prophecy that is fulfilled in chapter 16, 3 and 4. "Because of the provocation which you have provoked me to anger, and because you've made Israel sin." The king was supposed to set the pattern of godly living. When he played the fool, when he was an idolater, the people followed step. And here he had made the people sin by killing Naboth, innocent blood. Okay, and then it says, let's see, verse 23. And of Jezebel also the Lord spoke to me, saying, the dog shall eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel. That was also fulfilled in 2 Kings 9, verse 10, and verses 30 through 37. And then we have, and one belonging to Ahab, who dies in the city, the dog shall eat, and the one who dies in the field, the birds of heaven shall eat. It's a curse formula. It's repeated over and over through here. And then in verse 25, you see it mentions that Jezebel is the one who caused him all this trouble. He tries to explain it away, and it just doesn't work. Now, Ahab listens to Elijah, and he puts on sackcloth and ashes. He repents. He asks God to forgive him, and God says, because Ahab has done these things, because he is the king, has publicly shown his sorrow for what he's done, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to tear the kingdom from him in Ahab's lifetime, but I'll take it from his children. And as you know, Ahab had two children succeed him for brief periods of time. Now we come to chapter 22. 1 Kings 22 has caused people great difficulty in interpreting the Bible because basically of verses 17 through 23. I'm going to interpret 13 through 23 and 34 through 40. Let me set the stage for you. Jehoshaphat has married the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. Not Jehoshaphat, Jehoshaphat's son. So there is a political marriage taking place between the son of the king of Judah and the daughter of the king of Israel. And Jehoshaphat comes up and says, you know, that king that you let go, Ben-Hadad II, promised to give all the city that his father had taken from Israel back. And he didn't give Ramoth-Gilead back. Now, Ramoth-Gilead is kind of parallel with the city of Jezreel. And Jehoshaphat says, let's go up. You and I, let's make a political alliance, a military alliance. Let's go up and take that city back. And the king of Israel says, that sounds good to me. And Jehoshaphat says, let's ask the prophets about what they say. So beginning then about verse 7 through 12, they begin to search the prophets. There's 400 prophets of Yahweh. That seems a big number to me. I think probably these were the prophets of these two calf shrines in Dan and Bethel. But anyway, 400 of them. They ask every one of them, should we go up and do this? Is it God's will? And every one of them said, it's God's will. Go up and do it. You're going to be successful. Reminds me a whole lot of the prophets of Jeremiah's day who kept saying, peace and safety. And Jeremiah said, destruction and death. Well, these false prophets were claiming peace and victory. And Jehoshaphat is going to say, is there not one more prophet that we can go to? Now, the chief false prophet is Zedekiah. You see him in verse 11. He's also going to do this symbolic prophecy about victory. But in verse 13, let me pick up with Micaiah. Now, Micaiah is the messenger and the prophet, and the words of the prophet are uniformly favorable to the king. Please let your words be like the words of one of them and speak favorably. Now, what they're saying is, we want you to say what we want to say. You see, this king really doesn't want to hear from this prophet. He really doesn't want to hear God's word. He wants God to bless his plans. That's what he really wants. Now, so the prophet says in verse 14, Micaiah says, as the Lord lives, what the Lord says to me, I will speak. This prophet says, I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. I'm going to tell you what God tells me. This wasn't the prophet's message. It was God's message. Now, when it says, as the Lord lives, that's an oath. And the word Yahweh, all the words Lord through here is really in Hebrew the word Yahweh. It's the covenant name from God from Exodus 3:14. It's the Hebrew verb to be. It really means the ever-living God or the only living God. And that's where this oath formula comes from. Verse 15. But when he came to the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go up to Ramoth-Gilead to battle or shall we refrain? And the prophet answered him, go up and succeed and the Lord will give it into your hand. Woo! What's the deal here? Burning sarcasm. And this king picked up on it and said, I've told you before to tell me the truth. Now, I don't know if it was the inflection of his voice or the expression on his face, but the king knew that prophet was telling him just what he wanted to hear in a kind of ironical way or sarcastic way. And the king says to him, how many times must I endure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? And the prophet said, all right, you want to know what's going to happen? I'll tell you. Verse 17, I saw Israel scatter on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, they have no master. Let each one of them return to his own house in peace. Now, Judah is not even mentioned here. The sheep with no shepherd means the king's going to die. Oh, he didn't want to hear that. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, didn't I tell you he'd say something like that? I guess he was trying to rationalize away this bad prophecy. Verse 19, Micaiah said, therefore hear the word of the Lord. And this is what confuses and scares so many people. Listen to what I read it. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, much like Isaiah 6, and all the host of heaven standing by him on his right and on his left, the angelic host, all right, the angelic council. And the Lord said to this angelic group, who will entice Ahab to go up and fall or die at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said this and another said that. And the spirit, now mine has a spirit, but the Hebrew has the spirit, came forward, stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said to him, how? And the spirit said, I will go and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And God said, you are to entice him and also prevail. Go and do so. Now therefore the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all your prophets, and the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you today. Now what's this deal about God using lying as a tool? Well, this is an anthropomorphic scene, of course, and what we have here is the court scene in heaven. And the spirit seems to be Satan, much like the first chapter of Job, where Satan comes to the sons of God before God's throne. This deal about God being the source of evil. We must remember that in the Old Testament there is only one ultimate source, and that's God. Even Satan is in God's will and is God's servant. You might want to see something like this in 1 Samuel 16, 14 and 15, where it says, the evil spirit of the Lord came upon Saul. You might want to see in Ezekiel 14, where it's God that brings disaster on his people that break his covenant. Friends, the New Testament part of this, it'd be 2 Thessalonians 2, 11 and 12. It's not that God is the active force behind this. It's that God seems to allow this through the agency of evil in our world. Now, this is not the teaching passage on the source of evil. This is a brief illustration from one place in the Old Testament that is trying to convey monotheism, that God is in control of all things, good and evil. Blessings and cursings come from the one supernatural creator, redeemer God. The only living God is, of course, in control of all things. That is the main theological truth here. And if you get caught up in God sending evil or that, I think you're going to miss the whole point. James says that God doesn't tempt anybody. But, of course, Satan does. And we've got to see that behind this passage. You can't take one passage like this and build your whole theology of evil on it. It just won't work. You've got to look at the whole Bible. Now, let's see. Well, the prophet really has a problem here. The other prophet comes up and slaps him, and they put him in jail, saying, the king says, if I come back in peace, you know, we'll let him out. But feed him bread and water till I return. The king is just saying, I don't believe God said this, and I think you're a false prophet, and I'll deal with you when I get back. Because you see, Deuteronomy 18 and Deuteronomy 13 are the Old Testament criteria for false prophets. He was probably going to have this prophet killed. If he came back in peace, it meant this prophet was a liar. And that's exactly what he said in verse 28. Now, let me skip down to verse 34 and following. It says, a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king. The king told Jehoshaphat, Ahab said, you dress up in your royal robes and I'm going to disguise myself as a common soldier. Well, the Syrian army had orders to chase the king of Israel. They started chasing Jehoshaphat. He started screaming. I don't know what he screamed. Maybe his name maybe he was the battle cry of Judah. I don't know what he screamed, but they realized it wasn't Ahab. And a random soldier shot an arrow, and it randomly struck the king right in the joint of the armor, and he died. Now, friends, what seems random to man is purposeful for God. That's how this king's going to die, with that one seemingly careless arrow that just happens to hit in just the right place at just the right time to fulfill God's prophecy. No. Not a bit. Now, in verse 35, they propped him up in his chariot, and he bled all day in the chariot, because the king was the symbol for the army. If he was to die, the army would flee in panic. So he was a pretty brave man. He stayed there all day till the army won. In verse 36, there's that cry of every man go home. It was predicted back in 22:17. They brought him to Samaria. That's the place of burial now. That's where his father was buried. And it says, the dogs licked the blood. That's the prediction. Septuagint adds the word swine. That's from prediction back in 21:19. And then it says, now the harlots bathe there. Now the word harlot seems to be used in the sense of dog sometime. You might want to see Deuteronomy 23:18. So whether it meant that the prostitutes bathe there or the dogs bathe there, I'm not real sure. But this is a fulfillment of the dogs licking his blood. I know it's gross, but this is the way the book of 1 Kings is going to end, with Ahab, after the prediction of the Lord, dying. Well, I hope you'll outline this in your own. There's some great spiritual truths here, but take all three chapters, outline every paragraph in your own words, kind of go through it as a summary and pick out the theological truths. And I'll see you again, same time, same place next week.